No? All right. Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to my session. I know I'm between you and lunch, that age-old joke, so I'll try and keep it as interesting and hopefully as short as possible. Probably not on the short. I've got some awesome stuff I want to show you, so but I won't go over, let's put it that way. So my name is Hannah Gray. I am a back-end developer by trade. If you are of the DBA ilk, please don't throw rotten fruit at me. I know we tend to kind of tick you off, us developer breed, but hopefully I'm here today with a peace offering, as it were. I'm quite a fan of SSDT. So this is about SSDT for Visual Studio. If anybody here is after SSDT for business intelligence, which, you know, that's what happens when two products have the same name, same acronym, you are more than welcome to head out the door, and I won't think any less of you. It is a little bit confusing. But I'm a big fan of SSDT. It's something I think really sits between DBAs and the like and developers and really helps bridge that divide. So first of all, the problem. I'm a big fan in thinking that you solve a problem, not just using a technology because it's cool and fancy-smancy, latest greatest thing. So can you stick up your hand if you would fall loosely under the term of DBA or SQL developer or data architect or that sort of role in your organization? Awesome. You really don't throw anything at me, seriously. Cool. So I want you to have a bit of a think, and I apologize, sorry, I've been losing my voice, so bear with me. I want you to have a bit of a think about you and your organization and your day-to-day role and getting databases and changes in your databases out to production. Does this sound familiar? Developer makes a change, maybe they give you a script, if you're lucky, and they kind of hiff it over the fence, and you read it and you check that, well, they didn't really follow development standards, you know, they got the wrong name for the column. And you kind of rewrite it a bit and munge it around. And then they're going to give you another script because actually they forgot another change. And then you manually put them together. And then you might get around to running it on production. This real concept of developers sort of hiffing scripts over the fence to DBAs. Does it? Put your hand up if that's familiar to you. Yes. Awesome. Target audience. Great. My next question for you is put your hand up if you can tell exactly what your schema looked like a year ago. Cool, much fewer hands. Now that's a challenge I give all of you. It is difficult with databases, right? It really is. But so this is where SSDT really comes into its own. So we've created this divide for application development and database development. And for .NET or you know any coding, right? You talk to a developer and they've got these concepts of the SDLC, right? And all the things that come with that, continuous integration, build servers, quality, unit tests, automation, blah, 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 blah. Databases don't normally feature in this picture. Nobody talks about databases that way. So all these things that are really common for code development don't really exist for databases. Imagine if you could have unit tests for databases, quality assurance, automated deploys, yeah? So we've really made this world where there's two very different things going on in the development world. And you know that's a bit silly from my point of view. Increasingly, you don't have just a database, you have a database with an application, right? And more often than not, you don't really tend to have applications without some sort of data source either. So they are paired, and we should treat them as if they're the same. Imagine if you, I've done support for a lot of my development career, and the ability to be able to find out the version of the schema at a certain point in time that a bug occurs, priceless, right? Absolutely priceless. You've got the version of the code, and you've got the version of the database. That's really hard, right? Unless somebody happened to take a backup on that day, and you know. So let's take a look at how we can actually treat the databases the same way as applications. So obviously we're gonna use SSDT, that's what the talk's about. So that's an add-in for Visual Studio. It is free. And it works with, you don't have to have a certain level of Visual Studio, so you can even use it in Express. We're going to have a look at some source control and some continuous integration. These are concepts that are normally foreign to databases. Putting a database in source control or a database in continuous integration is, you know, say what? So, I like telling stories. So we're going to start with a happy database. Let's face it, in many cases, the production database is the source of truth, yeah? It would be inconceivable for somebody to tell you, no, the schema looks like this, when in fact in production it looks something different. So, you know, it's that index that you added for tuning, it's that table that you added for auditing because you needed to, and it's all done in production, right? So production is the source of truth. And, you know, this database is sitting there, it's happy as Larry in production, there's nothing disturbing it, there's no pesky developers that can touch it, right? It's fed, it's watered, it's taken care of, you've got dedicated people nurturing it and making sure that it's every beck and call is catered for. So if we want to try and break this cycle, the first thing we need to do is get a copy of production to be able to try and put it into source control and into continuous integration. So, now I do have to have a bit of a disclaimer. I am going to cheat a little bit. I'm using Visual Studio Online, and I really want to show you the strength of continuous integration with databases. So I am going to use recordings to accelerate through so I can show you, you know, bits that would normally take about 7-10 minutes to run to really get the power out of it. So I do apologize if you think less of me as a speaker because of that. But anyway, I have here two SQL Azure instances, and I've got a production database. Funnily enough, it's AdventureWorks, you know, just for something novel, right? And this is a real database. It's got data in it, you know, it's I haven't just made it up. There's row counts there and everything. And the way that we get this is we use something called sqlpackage.exe. So, a little bit about sqlpackage.exe. This is a command line tool that comes with SSDT. So it's the command line version for everything that you'll see me do in the GUI during this presentation. And so with sqlpackage.exe, it has a whole bunch of actions that come with it. These are only four of them that we'll cover today: extract, publish, deploy, report, and script. Funnily enough, if I talked to Seb, we wanted to get a copy of production, we're going to use extract. Kind of sounds familiar, right? So you can see here in my example that I have action extract. I've given it a server. I've given it a database name. I've given it a very secure password, of course. And I've said, could you please spit it out into this thing called a DAC pack? So a DAC pack, hands up if you haven't heard of a DAC pack or you don't know what a DAC pack is. Cool, all right, cool. So a DAC pack's a really interesting file. It's basically your schema in one file. It is the database equivalent of a DLL for .NET developers. All right. So, you know, DLL, all the code gets compiled down to a DLL. And for SSDT, the whole schema definition gets compiled down to a DAC pack. You can pick it up, you can move it, you can email it, you can send it to somebody else, you can put it on a network file, and you can still reuse it over and over and over. So it is the definition condensed down into one file. Really powerful. So we'll take this, and what we're going to do is obviously run it, because, you know, demos are useful for something. So we'll crank open the command line and run this command. And so what it's going to do is it's going to connect to the specified server and database, obviously, and it's going to read the schema from the production database. And it's going to basically backwards engineer it into this DAC pack. So I get this file that's spit out the other end. Woohoo, yay. And if we have a look at that DAC pack, just to prove this actually is doing something, I've now got a DAC pack there. So I could pick that up, I could email it to somebody else and say, hey, I've just taken production, this is what production looks right now. And they could use that DAC pack. You can use it for comparisons, and you'll see some of the other things that we can do with it as well. So that is extracting from production. Voila, we've now got a copy of prod. Now the interesting thing about DAC packs is they don't contain data. This is really key, right? So at Xero, this is a big deal for us. We don't want our customers' data to come out of production. That's secure private information. But it is the whole schema, everything about the schema. All the tables, all the views, all the stored procedures, all the logins, the roles, permissions, you name it, comes down with it. Oh, there you go. I'm already one out. There you go. So the next thing that happens is inevitably somebody like me sticks up my hand and says, I want to make a change. And you go, oh, no. Really? That database was fine the way it was. There's nothing wrong with it. Do you have to make a change? Yes, I do. Sorry. So some annoying developer comes along and they're always wanting to break things. Like, let's face it, this is what developers do. We break stuff. Yeah. I can say that because I'm one. So the next thing is how we then take that DAC pack and we do database development in Visual Studio. So we can create a database project, we can import the schema from production, and then we can change objects. So next on my list. So we've got the deck pack. We're going to open up Visual Studio. So I'm running in 2013. As I said, this is actually works in all versions of Visual Studio, and it goes back to 2012, and there's an older version for 2010 as well. We're going to create a new project. Funnily enough, this is the SQL Server database project. You can see I've been playing around with it recently. But you can just search for it by typing in SQL Server, funnily enough. And I'm going to call it, I don't know, how about Adventure Works? I like naming things simply. Works for me. So that's going to create a new solution in Visual Studio and an empty database project. So the database project doesn't have anything in it at this point in time. And so the way we resolve that is we are going to import from a DAC pack. We have this DAC pack that's extracted from production. So we're going to import DAC pack. And we're going to browse to the file that I showed you before, which is this DAC pack. No cards up the sleeve, promise. And there are a few settings here that you can set around the import. They don't make a huge amount of difference. They're very much preferences more than the impact that they have on your development lifecycle. So I'm not really going to go into them other than to say they're there, have a play if you particularly care about them kind of thing. So funnily enough, this is doing exactly what it says. It's deserializing the model that was in the DAC pack, and it's reading it out. And you can see here it goes through, and it basically reverse engineers the database. So it looks at the schema, this DAC pack definition of the schema, and it says, what scripts would be needed to make a schema that looks like that? And it works backwards. So you end up with a whole bunch of create scripts, right? So if we have a look, we get a folder per schema in the database. And inside the folders, we get a folder per type, tables, views, stored procedures. And in there, we get a file per object. Very nice and ordered. It's really interesting to note about SSDT that actually this doesn't matter. You could, in theory, have one file that has all of your objects for your entire database. Your developers might hate you, just saying, but it is possible. There's no structure. It's very much like .NET, right? It doesn't matter where your code actually is because in the end it all compiles down. It's the same for SSDT. So this is just a nice to have in the sense that it helps you find what you're looking for. But you can put anything wherever you like. If you want to have one file for your tables, go for it. So you get this nice GUI, and this is not designed to replace SQL Management Studio. So you've got it really isn't. You've got the T-SQL version, and you've got the GUI version, depending on where you like sort of working. I'm going to add a column, because this is what this was all about, right? So I've been asked to add an auditing column on this. And, you know, my DBAs, oh, not a datetime 2, the other one, that datetime 2. My DBAs keep yarning on at me about datetime 2s. I should use datetime 2s, not datetimes. It's a new thing, right? New standard moving forward. So I'm being a good, conscientious developer and using datetime 2. It's the right thing, right? Yes? Hopefully? Okay. So now the interesting thing is here is that you can build. Now, this is where we start foraying into developer territory. For developers, again, this is really natural. Build a database? What are you talking about? Now, it is very similar to parse in SQL Management Studio. So parsing gives you that really basic SQL sanity checking that the syntax makes sense, that there's not something totally wrong with it. But it does miss some things, right? It's not the script is definitely going to work. So you get some parsing. So if I do something, I can see that this succeeded, but if I really want to try and test, you know, what it does, I can go and manually change some of the script to something that's absolutely not valid in SQL, something that's rubbish. And I get syntax highlighting, and if I do another build, it actually tells me, hey, this is broken. So immediately you've got some validation that something's wrong with your developer. Well, sorry, your developer's work. Thought they would get a laugh. There's always something wrong with developers. No, sorry. So we've already got feedback about what the work that they're doing. But it is actually a lot more powerful than that. The really interesting thing to note here is it doesn't just do the same as parse in SQL Management Studio. It can do really cool things like warn you if you're referencing a table that it doesn't know about. So if I, as a developer, write a query and I've misspelled the table name, that's not invalid SQL. But SSDT can take it one step further and go, well, you've said select star from this random table, but I haven't got a table called that in my definition. And it'll give you a warning. So are you sure? you absolutely sure this is what you want? Then it does really useful things like that. So it's a little bit more powerful than parsing. So I'll just correct that mistake, as it were. And so now we can build, and we get that validation. So this is really very much developer-centric, just like for .NET. So I actually have this database locally on my machine. So I'm going to connect to my local host. And let's have a look at the database that I've got. Now, this is it's named differently. You'll notice I've got all the same tables, but the interesting thing here is that if I have a look at the columns, I don't have the column that I just added. So this is a really important note. The change I made in SSTT is a conceptual change only, right? It's a change to essentially source code files. It hasn't affected a physical implementation of a database yet. So the best I've got is modified date. So obviously what I want to do is I want to get my theoretical change into a real change. And we do that by publishing. So I'm going to point it to my local database. And AdventureWorks Dev, click OK, and hit a big fat publish button. Actually, no, I'm going to, save it as publish profile. So this is really powerful in SSDT. This is a XML file that contains a pre-canned set of connection strings, you know, authentication settings, the name of the database you connect to, some preferences. There's actually a whole range of options you can set. And it's saved in a file for reuse. Because, you know, you might want to reuse it and redo this over and over and over and over, right? So I get this green tick mark, and if I go and have a look at the columns in the database, yay, I have a credit date column. No way. So it's done it automatically. I didn't do anything. That's everything that it's done. And if we have a look behind the scenes, it does something really, really interesting. If we have a look at the script that this action produced, we can see it's just a standard T-SQL script. Everybody here, is anybody not familiar with SQL, SQL command? You guys all know SQL command. Cool, awesome. All right, I don't need to explain that. Wicked. So it has a bit of boilerplate at the beginning. You know, what's the database we're going to, with file paths, some other stuff that it's kind of worked out. And if we scroll down, we see that the only thing it's done is this alter table statement. Out of the entire database, it's figured out that that's the bit of SQL that it needs to run in order to make my hypothetical source code database implemented in my real physical database. It's got some other stuff underneath as well. You scroll down, this should be, you know, you should be able to recognize what it is. It's refreshing a whole bunch of views and various other things that depend on that table. So SSDT has recognized that that table has a change, and there are some other actions that need to be taken as a result, and it's done it for you. This is pretty cool, right? This is human error factor being sort of removed from the equation. So this is the change script. Now, the way that SSDT works is it basically builds a hypothetical model in memory. So you'll notice that all of the files I showed you before were create statements, and that kind of runs against the grain because you think, no, I want an alter. I want to add a column, right? Everything's done in create because you're showing a definition of a database as if it were brand new when you're working on the source files. And then when you run it, when you point it to a target, it dynamically figures out what the changes are. Now, for those of you who are going, oh, yeah, dynamic. Oh, yeah, that means it'll get it wrong. Okay, I'll address that. I will come back to that, promise. I promise for the skeptics. But in memory, it's working out, okay, if I ran all of these create statements, what would be the resulting schema? Okay, now look at the target. Okay, read in that schema. What are the differences between the two? What do I need to run to make A look like B? Hence, you get a dynamically generated script. It's pretty cool, actually. So, the interesting thing about this is great in the sense that it allows developers to make a change, right? They're working in their own natural environment, they're in Visual Studio. This is all very home for us as .NET devs. But the reality is that there's usually a reason why that this stereotype of developers hitting scripts over the fence, right, to the operations team or the DBAs, is around process. It's around making sure that they don't do too much damage because, man, we don't know what we're doing, seriously. I make stuff up on a daily basis. No, I'm kidding. There's a reason that it happened that way, right? And it's around that sanity checking. So how do you ensure that the developer hasn't broken things? you know, that there are standards that have to be adhered to. There are things you don't want them to touch because there's a reason they're that way. They might be manic and insane, but there's a reason. Leave it alone. So you need to put quality control around the changes. But what's interesting is, what is quality for a database, and how do you ensure that it happens? So normal, if you are fortunate enough to have your database under source control, there are plenty of ways to do that. It can be as simple as scripting out the database into SQL files, you know, once a month and checking into source control. Or it could be using Redgate or various other tooling that's around. This is kind of what it looks like, though, right, if you do have source control for your database. You commit the changes to source control, and then you manually go and make the same change in your actual destination system. And this is kind of a bit wrong. Again, if we liken this to code, you know, this is that we want to treat our database the same way we treat our applications. We want to use continuous integration. We want to commit the changes to source control. We want to see it turn up on a continuous integration server. We want it built. We want the success metric. And I'll come back to this metric, what it is, you know, what's quality and success for a database. And we want to package the output. Funnily enough, we've already looked at what that might be, a DAC pack. We've seen this kind of output that you can get. And we want to deploy it. Wouldn't this be, you know, this magical world that you could be in? And so everybody thinks about continuous integration as very much being a code and application a developer domain. But this is very much accessible for databases. So we're going to put it through continuous integration. We're going to take a look at SQL Server unit testing. And we're going to have a look at something called code analysis as well, which might blow your mind a little bit, hopefully. Okay. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to check this into source control. So I've got a Visual Studio Online account set up, VentureWorks and SSDT. Yeah, great names, I know. I've got no code in this. This is blank. So the first thing I want to do is I want to add this. So I am using Git. So for those of you who don't know Git, this might confuse you a little bit. So I want to create a local Git repository. I want to commit all of the files that I have added to the solution. So I'm just going to do an initial commit. Now, if you don't know Git, this changes only on my local machine, even though I'm committing. It's not on a central server anywhere yet. So I've got source control locally. So next thing I want to do is I want to tell it, hey, I want you to talk to Visual Studio Online. I want you two to communicate and be one and the same. So my project is part of Visual Studio Online. So I'm going to select that project. Ignore the test Git. Sorry, I was playing around. So that first connects to Visual Studio Online. And the next thing is I'm going to tell Visual Studio Online, take my work that I've got locally and put it up on the cloud, please. Thank you very much. Wait for a couple of progress bars. And so now my code is sitting in Visual Studio Online. Now, if you've played around with Visual Studio Online, it is one of several tools you can choose to use. But that's a continuous integration server. So it can build our code. So we're going to create a build. Funnily enough, it's going to be a continuous integration build. So we'll go to new build definition. CI build. Told you, my names are great. Yeah. And we're going to say, please do this. Please run this build every time I check in. So that's the whole point of continuous integration. We're going to accept all of the defaults, but we do need to tell it what the solution file name is to build. And this just works out of the box, right? You genuinely don't have to set anything else up. So we're going to save this. Build files don't need to be checked in. They just automatically sync up to Visual Studio Online. So you'll see if I refresh the code in the browser, you can see I've now got code. And if I have a look at the builds, I now have a build called CI build that it knows about and knows how to progress. So what? You know, this is, again, for developers, this is stock standard. I'm going to trigger a CI build. I'm going to run it as high priority just to cheat and cut down the build time, sorry. But if we run that, we'll see exactly what we saw in Visual Studio. In Visual Studio, we ran a build solution locally, and it turned green or red, depending on whether somebody had done something daft. Okay, so this is the same thing in the cloud. It doesn't have to be in the cloud. You could have local build servers, but, you know. Again, continuous integration for databases is very much not a thing. It's quite novel. So this is repeating exactly what was done in Visual Studio, just on the command line. I'm going to accelerate through that, accelerate our time, and you see we get a successful build. Yay! Woohoo! But we've got this green tick mark. That's cool, right? That's some validation around your database that it's okay. And so we've got a drop folder, and this is the output from the build. We've got another deck pack, right? Starting to see a bit of a pattern going on here, hopefully, maybe. So the build has compiled all of those schema definitions down into a deck pack, and I can download a copy of it. So now I've got my change in a deck pack. I could send it to the person next to me and say, hey, here's a deck pack that includes production plus my change, and so on and so forth. Rinse and repeat. So just playing devil's advocate, just really quickly going to run through why, if you haven't played around with continuous integration, especially if you're from a sort of DBA background, why it might benefit you. And really it comes down to the fact that it's a bit more infallible than humans, is the summary. So if I go back and make my rubbish change to the code, you know, I know that if I build it locally, I get an error. But hey, I could be oblivious to that, right? I'm on a mission. I'm just going to check in whatever I want. I'm not going to build it locally. I'm going to not, you know, just, I'm a developer. I can do what I want, right? You guys are nodding your heads like, yeah, this is a thing, isn't it? Yeah, okay. It's all right. It's a stereotype for a reason. And just to prove that this is of some use, you can see it's kicked off another build automatically. I didn't do that myself. And again, we'll accelerate time for us. And we're going to get a big failure. All right. So I didn't remember to do it as a developer, but the build server does. So immediately we've got that, this is not safe to go to production. It's not safe to go anywhere. Your developer needs to be smacked across the wrist and sorted out. So yeah, whoops, my bad. So we'll just quickly correct that just before we go on to the other demos. So this is the whole point of continuous integration. As I've said, this is really not new to developers in the room, but for databases, this is kind of, you know, but novel. So the next thing is quality. So I've talked a little bit about metrics and quality and how do you ensure that what you've got is actually something kind of good. We've got a really low level of quality so far. We've got some sort of parsing, SQL syntax checking, but it's not great. You know, that's not the be all and end all. There's stuff that you guys are trained to look for in scripts that isn't covered by just checking that they've used the right SQL syntax. So what can we do around that? So we can do unit tests. Again, unit tests are something that for application developers is a thing. Databases. Tell a developer that they have to write unit tests for a database, and they'll just kind of give you this weird, what? Kind of look, right? So in SSDT, there's the ability to do unit tests for databases. So if we have a look at SQL Server Object Explorer, this is not SQL Management Studio. Again, this isn't a replacement. But you can actually browse the project as if it were a real database. This is a hypothetical, again, this hypothetical representation of what the database would look like. It's not looking at any local instance. So you can see all the tables that we've been playing around with. And if I go into the stored procedures, I can right-click and I can create a unit test. Now I'm going to use C# because I'm a C# developer by nature. So I'm afraid I'm copping out and using that. Now, don't let the C# put you off, especially if you're from a database ilk, because the interesting thing is, once we hook it up to a local database, this does need a real database to run against. Once it processes, you'll see that something really interesting. It's in SQL. So they are unit tests in SQL. It's not bad, actually. So if anybody was worrying about the whole C# thing, no, they're written in SQL. So this is a dummy one that it created as part of saying, I want to test the stored procedure. And you know, it's got all sorts of conditions that you can use. So you can check what the result is. You write a query, and then you verify what the result is. You might expect 4 rows back. You might expect it to run in under 200 milliseconds. You might expect no rows back, whatever you want it to do. So this is the sort of conditions that you can do. Now, this has got some use. It does. But I decided to just kind of break this a little bit, you know, as I do, being a developer. And so I want to try something a bit alternative. So instead, hopefully most of you can figure out what this does. Have a look at the schema and find me any columns that are date time 2 and have a scale more than 2. Yeah? Now this is one of my DBA's pet hates. We happen to not need that level of precision. It's just excess storage that we do not need to take up, right? So 2 is kind of the maximum that we particularly need. So what if we could run this and verify that whenever somebody makes a change, they don't do this? Now, can anybody tell me what the result's going to be? Really? Nobody can tell me what the result's going to be? A table with column names in it. Is it going to find any? Yes. Yeah, because I was being a lazy developer before, and my create a date column that I added was the default of date time 2.7. Right? This is exactly what it's designed to catch. So we can grab that SQL and put it into a unit test. So I'll copy and paste that into our SQL thing. So I'm kind of cheating a little bit, but you know, this is cool, right? And I can say that actually what I want as a result is I want nothing back. So a good result is I get no results back. Does that make sense? Yeah? So we're going to remove the inconclusive test. That's the default that comes when you create a unit test, so you need to remove that before you set anything. Let's save that, and we'll run them. And amazingly enough, people's predictions will come true, hopefully, once the computer grinds away. We've got a unit test coming up. Hey, failure. And if we have a look at the error, it's not the greatest error in the world, but it's basically saying kind of what we thought. We got a result set back. We expected the result set to be empty, and it wasn't. So that tells us that there were indeed columns that were of the wrong type, that don't meet our database standards. So that's one way to do it. There is another way. Now, I need to give a bit of a disclaimer. I'm going to delve into some code that may worry some people. It's not my intention to do that. Really, what I want to make you guys aware of is that this is a possibility, that if it's something that interests you, you can go and investigate and learn about it, because I think it's worth knowing that it exists. But don't, you know, just look at it as a high-level concept. So the other option that we can do is SSDT has... There we go. Yeah, that one. If we run the same query, if you were particularly interested, we could run the same query and, you know, you could actually see what the column was. So run that on the local database and you get your answer. So SSDT also has this concept of a code analysis. So I'm just going to remove the SQL unit tests because I want to replace it with something better and faster and stronger and more amazing. So if we go to the properties of the project, we've got this code analysis tab. And these are ones that Microsoft have provided for you out of the box. There's some really simple ones, like don't use select star and, you know, some pretty basic ones. So again, you could turn these on and you would get warnings that something was not right with the proposed changes. Cool. But again, that's still not quite, you know, I'm sure you guys have things that, you know, specific coding standards, sorry, SQL standards that you want to adhere to. So we really want to customize it like we did in the previous test. So we can do that by making custom code analysis rules. So I'm going to add a, so this is getting a little bit into the .NET side. As I said, don't let that worry you. It's just to show that it is a possibility. Find yourself a pet developer and throw them at this. So I'm going to create a custom library. I'm going to install a NuGet package which has all of the SSDT DLLs in it, which allows it to run custom rules over a DAC pack. So this is available on NuGet. Once the computer connects to the internet. And I'm going to install the same NuGet package also into my unit test project that I created earlier. So I haven't removed the unit test project that's still there because I'm going to need it later on. And once it's there, I again am cheating. I have one that I prepared before the show. So I have a custom rule here, okay? Don't bother trying to read all the code. It's really, that's not the point at all. So I can copy and paste that rule in here. And really, there's sort of three main things to look at. Really, that's really all you need to look at, and you don't need to know C sharp. I do need to add a .NET DLL, .NET framework DLL in order to get this to work. But that's just regularly available as part of the .NET framework. So the interesting thing here is, the first thing is that we have a defined supported element types. So this is saying this rule will only apply to tables. Don't run it on still procs. Don't run it on views, right? I'm only interested in running this table on, running this rule on tables. Next thing, again, ignore all of the code, is this line here, which is saying for each of the columns in the table that I'm looking at, okay, I want you to check whether it's date time two with excessive scale, which is our next if statement. And if we have a look at what that actually is, again, ignore all the code that's around it, really it boils down to this single line right here, which is saying, is the data type date time two, and is the scale greater than two? This is exactly the same as the SQL unit test we wrote before. Identical. It's just done in C#. And there's a couple of advantages to that. Not C#, but using code analysis rules, sorry, as opposed to SQL unit tests. So if I run this, save it first, actually. And run the unit tests. I need to write a unit test, don't I? That would kind of help. Again, I've got one before the show. So this is a unit test. So all this unit test does is provide a wrapper over the rule. The file that we made before is just the rule. It's a declaration of intent. This is the code that actually says I need to make sure that this adheres to that intent. So I'm going to add a reference to our rules that we've made. And again, ignore all of the code. First things first, we're going to say load up my DAC pack. So we've got this database, this theoretical database with this change that the developers made. I want you to go and find it. Then, funnily enough, after you ignore most of the code, analyze it. Run the rules against it. I've made this custom rule. I want you to tell me if it meets those rules. Easy, right? And we're saying at the very end that we expect nothing to be found. So good is that we don't find anything. Same, right? Exactly the same as the SQL that we've used before. The SQL unit test, that we used before. Now, I do have some code down the bottom to freak people out about how to find DAC packs. It's just a helper function that I've written. But there's nothing particularly onerous there. So that builds, great. If we go and run the unit tests, yay, fails. Same thing. So it's also found our failure, that we expected something, that it hasn't met our standards, hasn't met our development standards. All right, so the next thing is obviously turning this into something really useful, because at the moment I'm manually running these tests. Whether they're SQL unit tests or code analysis rules, I'm manually running them as a developer. And as we all know, you can't trust developers. Right? So I'm gonna fix my mistake, just cause. If I run the tests again, we should see green. Green is good. This is very simple, right? Green check marks and red crosses. This is how everybody's life should be for development and for databases. So I'm going to check this into source control. Push that up into Visual Studio Online. And the interesting thing here is if we have a look at our build definition that we created before, we don't actually have to do anything. If we have a look at the default settings that came with it out of the box, and look under test, automated tests, it's already configured. I didn't do this, right? This is what it comes like to automatically run anything that has test in the name. And you remember I named the project My Database Unit Tests. There's a reason for that. So now we can get a build going. Again, we're going to accelerate through time. I love this. Accelerating through time, great. Just need a time machine, closest I can get. And we can see at the end, it's going to do an extra step compared to last time, run VS test runner. So it's picked up that there's tests, and then it needs to do something. And we get this green, right? This is gold. We've seen that there is a test and it passed. So now we have a build that has a DAC pack you can download, that has a change, that has gone through not only the parsing type SSDT sanity check, but also our own custom rules enforcing whatever your development standards are. Right? That's really powerful. Now, the pros and cons of these are SQL Server database unit tests require a physical database to run against. So that's got pluses and minuses. Code analysis rules, the downside there is that they have to be installed on everybody's machine, every developer's machine in order to run. The advantage of wrapping them up in a unit test, like we've done in this example, is that you don't need to do that. The unit test executes the code analysis rule, meaning that it will work wherever, even on a build server. Okay. hence why I've just shown to, chosen to show you that. Right. So we have quality. And you could keep writing more custom rules, whether it's database unit tests or whether it's code analysis rules to enforce whatever it is that it's important to you as a database engineer or a DBA or a data architect or whatever your role happens to be, so that you don't have to spend time checking for this stuff. Imagine how much time you might conceivably get back in your day if you didn't have to check that developers were using date time 2 with the scale of 2 and other mundane things. So the last, so far we've got changes, they are building, they haven't actually gone anywhere yet, they're all very theoretical at this point. So we actually have to get somewhere with them, and that's usually testing environments and production. And we're a bit of a way from there, so we need to tie it all together. So we've got one more door to go through. So we're going to have a quick rip into SQL command variables, but nobody stuck up their hand before, so we'll go through that. Have a look at some of the smarts you can put around your database. One of the interesting things about databases is realistically they're different in every environment. Not just data, but there might be something crucially different between environment. It might be that linked server obviously has to point to a different server name in your staging environment and your production environment. So there's some smarts around testing environments that you need to use and publish profiles. Cool. So the first things first, we're going to add a post-deployment script. So these are this is a special type of script that you can add. And there's only one that you can add. And I've written some SQL to go in it. So a post-deployment script is really special. It runs every single time after a deploy of a database. I'll repeat that again, every single time after the deploy of a database. So can anybody tell me what's wrong if I got the post-deployment script to run these insert statements? Sorry? Fail the second time? Yeah, it would fail the second time if I had some sort of primary key or some sort of constraint on it, absolutely. Duplicates, I think somebody said duplicates. Yeah, absolutely. You'd get attempted duplicate insertion into the database. So that's kind of useless, right? So instead, you just need to think about this when you do your post-deployment scripts. It's about just writing them to be idempotent. So we can use a merge statement. Exactly the same data. Now, this is an example of what we do use post-deployment scripts for, which is reference data or lookup data or whatever term you want to throw at it. My argument for this is that there is core data to any application that is database driven, which is required for that application to work. And you could argue that that is actually part of the definition of the database, right? If you have a bug, it could legitimately be because the lookup data row isn't there. So it should be source controlled. It's part of the database definition as well. So if you think about your database being entirely deployable from scratch to any environment, including whatever is required to make it run, you can put your reference data in your post-deployment script here, and it's done. It's inserted as part of a deploy. So we'll copy that and put it into our post-deployment script. And just to prove that it works, we're going to do another publish. So this is to my local database. And we'll see that, again, it goes through. And if I have a look at the database and have a look at the hobby table, which is what we were inserting data into, I will now see that it has the required rows. Right? Pretty cool. So now what? The next thing that's usually different is, as I said, maybe a linked server, something that's crucially different. So SQL command vars, if you have a look at the properties of the project, you can add a variable. So we're going to add a variable called environment. This is just one example of many things that you can do with SQL command vars. And we're going to use that to change the reference data in each environment. So this is, again, a common scenario. So we can go back to our reference data script, and we can say, if the value for environment, and this is a value that will be passed in at deployment time, is dev, then I want you to insert these values. For every other environment, these values aren't legitimate for whatever reason. You know, I'm making up business rules as we go. But, you know, this is the sort of thing that you might have to deal with. And so now we've got environment-specific logic in our deployment. SQL command vars are incredibly powerful. They're basically string substitution. So you can use them for anything that you have strings in your database. So as I said, the destination server for a linked server definition. You cannot use them as part of an object definition. So for example, if you want a table and the table name is a SQL command var, that just doesn't work, right? You can't get that dynamic with your SQL, I'm afraid. You can do other interesting things. One of the things we use it for is the version number. So we have a SQL command var called version number and a table which has versions, funnily enough. And so we take in that value at deploy time and we insert a new row and we say, this version of the database was deployed at this time by this user. We've now got audit history of when database schema changes were made and when it was actually deployed to production. It's not bad. So the next step is that we need to get things ready to go into production. And usually that means going through testing. So I'm going to create another couple of published profiles. First of all, I'm going to create one for stage. So I'm just going to cheat and use my stage connection string. Now, SQL Azure is SQL Server authentication only. So that's why I'm using SQL Auth. Obviously, if you're using something else, you could use Windows. And my database name is AW Stage. So put that in there. And it's prompting me for, hey, when I use this, what value do you want for environment? I'm going to use preprod, and I'm going to save that. And I'm going to repeat the process for production. So now I have connection strings, configurations, and settings that are unique to each of my testing environments. And they're kind of canned. They're reusable. So now I have two published profiles. Now, there is one side note that I have to say for SQL Azure, because it uses SQL Auth, SSDT will never store a password in a published profile, right? It's a security thing. It's stored on your machine, bound to your machine and your login. So because of that, in order to, if you want to use these with SQL Azure, you just need to manually add the password in. So we're just going to edit that file and add in my incredibly secure password to the connection string. Yes, I'm using the SA account. Somebody can throw something at me later. So I'm just going to do that for both of my published profiles and save those. And so now I can check those in, and I have published profiles that are available for use by anybody to publish to any of our testing environments. Now, obviously, if you didn't want anybody to publish to production, you might not want that password to get out, and developers might just go mad. That's fine. You know, but this is just to show you the opportunities and the options that are available. So you can go as far as continuous delivery. So you could, as part of your continuous integration build, say, build, show me the metric of success or failure, and then also deploy to a staging environment. Right, SQL package is command line, so you can tell it, here's the published profile. You've already got everything you need to know. You've got the database, you've got the server, you've got the settings. Just go and do it. Right? So you could even get your databases in, not just from continuous integration, but into continuous delivery, if you really wanted to. So put your hands up if you're one of those people that, when I talked about the automatic generation of scripts, started getting the heebie-jeebies. Yeah, no, be honest, absolutely be honest. Yeah, it's a fair concern, right? Anybody who stands up here and says, this tool automates everything and gets it right all the time. Yeah, no, okay, right. I'm not going to tell you that. I'm not going to sell you on that. So it's very realistic that you're going to want some sort of sanity check. I mean, there's a reason that you guys are hired as DBAs, as SQL professionals. It's not just around checking that people use the right data types and stuff. It's other things. Like, somebody might be legitimately doing a table rebuild, but you don't want to do the order of operations in that particular order. You might know of a way that, you know, you can do an online operation instead. You know, this is where your knowledge comes into play, right? This is where your expertise comes into play. So instead of promoting, hey, you know, you should just automatically deploy to production, please do, by the way, if you feel like it, absolutely do. But there are alternatives. If you would like to have that sanity check before it goes to production, let's have a play around with that. So we're going to go back to SQL package.exe. We talked about actions at the very beginning, deploy report and script. were two of the other ones. So we're going to have a bit of a play around what we can do with those to help support those who have a bit of jitter about the idea of automatic deployments to production. So I can take the last build. This is the last successful build. It's passed all the metrics. It's got a big green tick. It's passed my unit tests, everything else. And I can download the drop zip, as it is in SQL Azure, Visual Studio Online. And I can take this infamous DAC pack, right? We keep coming back to this DAC pack. This is critical to SSDT. But that DAC pack is a version of all the changes that I now know I want to release to production. So I'm just gonna actually copy that locally, just cause, a bit easier. And now I can run SQL package.exe. So I've got some command line options available to me. So if we have a look, we've got two. Deploy report, funnily enough, I pointed at a DAC pack. I pointed at a publish profile. Remember, it's got my connection strings, it's got my settings, it knows what I want to do when I talk to production, what settings I want to deploy with, and I've got it in an output path. And I'll show you what a deploy report does. And then the next one is script, okay? So funnily enough, deploy report generates a report, and script generates a script. Yeah, okay. Naming, yeah, it's all about naming. So let's have a look at what these actually do. So I'm just going to copy and paste these and run them in the command line. I am going to go into my project. So my project was called AdventureWorks into the AdventureWorks SSDT project. This is so I can use the published profile that I created before. I want to use that to my advantage. It's got all the settings I need. So copy and paste. It's connecting to my production server. It is, again, reading the schema doing everything that you'd expect, except not actually affecting any change. Okay, no changes affected whatsoever. And so we're doing the same thing for script as well. And you can see it generates these two files. Great, what are these files? What are these magic files she's going on about? So let's have a look at them. So the first one is an XML file. And this is gold, right? This is a summation of all of the changes that will happen. If you run this DAC pack with this publish profile and tell it to publish, to actually affect change, this is what it will do. So immediately, you as a DBA can see, okay, it's doing an alter on the employee table. Oh, I'm not worried about that. Or alternatively, actually, I am worried about that. That's a big table. That's a big, you know, I don't know. It depends on you and your situation. But you can look at that and you can derive meaning from, you know, related to you and your business as to whether that's something that you should investigate. And we've got the refresh, right? So immediately, we've got a summation of the changes. And similarly, if we take a look at the script, it's a SQL script, and this should look really familiar. We've already kind of seen one of these earlier on. We can see at the top, we've got variables being set. It knows the database. It knows the value for environment that we want to use. This is all stuff out of our published profile. And if we scroll on down, again, it's got a bit of boilerplate, but we've got that altered table statement, right? So it's done the same thing as before. It's done a hypothetical comparison of the destination schema and the source schema and said, what would the script be that I would need to run? It hasn't run it. I must emphasize this, hasn't run it. But it has figured out what it would be. And if we crank on down the page, we'll see that it has done all the refreshing, same as before, and more refreshing, and more refreshing, and more refreshing. And at the end, we have a post-deployment script. Now, the interesting thing to note here is the post-deployment script will always be there, but this is where your if statement comes into play, right? This is where your SQL command vars come in. That will never run in production. So now we have a script that you can manually, because you've eyeballed it, you've checked it, you've gone, yeah, that's fine, actually. The developer for once knew what they were doing. Great. Okay. And you've now got something that you can take to production. Keep getting my slides out of order, I apologize. So, yay, we've gone full circle, right? That was the SDLC in, 50-odd minutes. For a database, continuous integration, quality checks. If you wanted to, you could get into continuous deployment. And still keeping the power with you as a DBA. And the point here is really about you getting time back for you to do the things that you are trained in a specialist at. So the question I get asked is really about, Yeah, whatever. We at Xero, we really do use this day in and day out. To be more specific, we use it for everything. Schemas, logins, reference data, linked servers. We even use it for SQL agent jobs. The entire definition of our 60-odd databases are all in SSDT. If you work on a database, you must make the change in SSDT. We have published profiles that mean any developer can pick up any product, click it twice, hit publish, they have a fully working copy of the database instantly. That's really powerful from a productivity point of view. And you can see the change, obviously with source control, you can see the changes anytime. And we used exactly what we've shown here, using SQL package.exe command line to do automated deploys to our 40-odd testing environments. And the process that I showed you with generating scripts and deploy reports is exactly what we use to go to production with as well. There's an interesting quote from one of the DBAs that I work with, and he sounds really silly here. He said, "Thing is, I realized every time I thought SSDT was doing something stupid, it was actually me being stupid." Now, don't get me wrong, this guy's actually quite bright. So, but it's an interesting observation, right? There was this level of trust that we had to get with the tooling. Now, I've said it may not get everything right. We found a couple of things it doesn't quite get right. But what it has done is it's actually reduced human error. And it's a good example today, right? You make a change, you affect that change, and then you go, oh, I forgot about the fact that I need to refresh all those views. That's a really common thing to forget, right? You're so focused on just getting out schema changes. There's all this other stuff that has to be catered for. And so that's what we were finding. We were repeatedly finding, why has it generated this really long script? And when we checked it, it was picking up on things that we had forgotten, right? Now, as I said, I won't lie, there's one or two things we've managed to catch it out on, but you know, on the weight of it, one or two things compared to the fact we release databases about three times a week. You know, one or two things doesn't really scale up to be a big problem. So for this is a huge benefit. So it means DBAs can do what they were trained to do and what they enjoy doing, use their expertise where it counts. And make the most impact. They're not checking that I use the right data type. They're not checking that they don't have to handcraft scripts because a developer kind of just chucked some via email at them. It's all automated for them. And then they can really get the most out of it. So there's a few sessions which, hilariously, because it's Friday, you may have already missed, but if you do have a chance, and also some of the hands-on labs. Otherwise, have a look at some TechNet and the Virtual Academy have some interesting stuff as well. And please complete your session evaluation form. Very much appreciated. Otherwise, thank you very much for your time. I am around if you have any questions, and I hope you enjoy today. Go and enjoy lunch. Thanks, guys.